On this episode of China Unscripted, we sit down with a retired Air Force general to talk about what the Chinese Communist Party fears most about America. And it's not our military. Hi, welcome to the China Unscripted podcast. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Kanista.
We are in Washington, D.C. for an exciting podcast with General Robert Spalding. He's a retired brigadier general with the U.S. Air Force who has spent years studying China and working on China strategy. In 2017, he was the U.S. Air Force defense attaché stationed in Beijing. After that, he was a strategic advisor to the White House on national security issues. Thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
So, General, the Trump administration has started using the term strategic competition to describe the U.S. relationship with China. What does that mean?
Well, I think what you see in the globalized world today is, you know, particularly from China, is the ability to use the openness of the West as a means for both extending its influence abroad, but also suppressing those liberal norms that it finds that are inimical to its own control over the country.
But I thought China was a great friend of the U.S. with win-win cooperation.
Well, that's what I thought, too. In fact, you know, I spent my first 2 years living in Shanghai, going to Tongji University, traveling the country, meeting the people, learning the language. In fact, there was a number of times when, you know, I was complimented because I'd be speaking to somebody on the phone, and then they'd see me in person, and they'd say, where's that Chinese person I was talking to? And I said, that's me.
Oh, wow.
So I really enjoyed that time, and you know, as I was telling you before, you know, that part of my association with China, you know, I came away with just this incredible sense that this country was going places. It was certainly a strategic relationship with the country, but it was more beneficial to the United States than not. And, you know, my intent was to retire from the Air Force and go to live in China, start a business, and really, you know, take advantage of this warm and strong, friendly relationship.
When was this?
So I first went to Defense Language Institute in May of 2001. Of course, this was right after the EP3 incident, so I was worried that I wasn't going to actually be able to go in the country because, you know, there is a tense relationship between the U.S. and China. Of course, in September of that year, 9/11 happened, and then, you know, subsequently, you know, things kind of calmed down. And then the following year, so after a year in Chinese language training in the summer of 2002, I moved to Shanghai, to Pudong, and went to Tongji University. Traveled the country, just really got to know the Chinese people and culture and history and geography and everything.
Well, that really is one of the Communist Party's greatest strategic advantages, like how great China is.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly, I mean, the people were just so incredibly inviting and warm. And even when we would go to very poor sections of China, we were always greeted, you know, people would want to invite us into their homes to eat. And it was just, it was really incredible, the reception that we received. It was almost like being a rock star, especially in those areas where there weren't a lot of foreigners because, you know, we looked different than the rest of the people. And, but at the same time, you know, it was just, I got the sense that the Chinese people were very much like Americans, which, you know, means that they're very inward focused, focus on their family, focus on, you know, their own lives. They didn't really care about what happened in the world, which most Americans are pretty much the same way. You know, it's all about, you know, friends or football or whatever their interests are. They don't really care about geopolitics. They don't care about, you know, what's going on. They want to have a good job. They want to send their kids to school. They want to have a roof over their heads, all the standard things. And from the, you know, in terms of Asia, because I've traveled over the other countries in Asia, I thought that their population was most like Americans in terms of their kind of inward focus and also their friendly friendly nature.
Well, I have to say, General Spalding, you definitely strike me as a China hater, as being anti-China.
Why do you hate Chinese people?
It's terrible. Yeah.
But it's funny you use the term like that. You were treated like a rock star. because this is I've heard that a lot with the idea of elite capture, the idea that well-placed people in the West will go to China, have a great time, be treated like a rock star, and suddenly they come away from China saying all the nice things about China, but they don't see the other side.
I mean, yeah, it's not just that, though. I was in China roughly the same time you were, 2002, and just by virtue of being an American in China at that time, I felt people treated me differently, and especially, like, maybe not so much in Shanghai and Beijing, but out on, like, the countryside.
Like, out in Yunnan, you mean?
In, like, you know, like, the villages of Yunnan province. Like, people would invite me to stay in their homes and eat dinner with them. Like, in that sense, because I was nobody politically.
Family in Yunnan was trying to elite capture you.
No, and I meant it in the same way that you're saying it now, not the way you meant, Chris. You know, that came later. I was ignored by the government because, you know, I was there. It was a different time in 2002 than it is today. And I did not feel the oppression of the state. Of course, I knew that, you know, people would come into my house and, you know, we would find evidence that people had been there. But for the most part, you know, I wasn't courted by anybody. It was just the normal. So I think, you know, I just remember vividly one time we're having dinner in Shanghai, and it was me and my wife and our two kids. And we look outside, and we're just right in front of the window of the restaurant, and there's like 30 people standing outside watching us eat dinner. So that was in the same way that Matt was talking. I think there's just this fascination of foreigners.
Even he can use chopsticks.
Yeah, that's right.
Or like how they were impressed with your Chinese language.
Oh, the funniest thing is I bought this motorcycle, this 1940s motorcycle, you know, it was brand new when I bought it in a factory in Nanchang, and I had it. It's hilarious. So I ride a train to Nanchang because I seen these. I saw one of these motorcycles that had a sidecar, and I'm like, I want to get one of those. And they said, well, you can get one. You get them brand new at the factory, and it costs about U.S. dollars $1,400. I'm like, okay, I'm going to ride a train to Nanchang, and I'm going to buy one of these motorcycles. And so I go to the factory, and sure enough, here we are in like a big Quonset hut. They're making these motorcycles, and so I pay them the money, and move the motorcycle out to the front of the building. And I'm like, how am I going to get this thing to Shanghai? And one of the guys with me just waves down a truck, and the truck stops. I don't know where this guy was going. And I said, hey, can you take this thing to Shanghai? And sure, I paid him like 300 renminbi. A week later, the motorcycle showed up in Shanghai. So, I mean, it was a crazy, fun place to be.
Oh, that sounds like a real adventure.
It was an adventure. The whole time in China was an adventure.
But obviously later on, your sort of view of China changed, well, specifically the Chinese Communist Party. What was really the reason for that?
Well, so as I said in the video, there's a distinct separation in my time of my engagement with China, the Chinese people, and then my engagement with the government and specifically the Communist Party. And that occurs somewhat later, like in 2013, when I go to the Council on Foreign Relations and I realize that the Air Force is looking to send me to China. And I know China. I know the Chinese people. I speak the language. But I don't know anything about the government. I have very little understanding about how things work. And so I set about learning, and in that process of learning, I came to understand that there's two parts to China. There's China. There's the Chinese people. There is a history and culture and vibrancy, and then there's this other side. And you know, I'm not afraid to say it's a dark side, which is the Chinese Communist Party. And I think until you experience both fully, you don't really get China. You know, the Chinese Communist Party takes the mantle of 5,000 years of culture and takes all that vibrancy and that dynamism that is China, that appealing nature of it, and wraps that cloak around themselves. And basically, that's what they use to, you know, essentially sell you that, you know, essentially they are acting on behalf of the Chinese people. But then when you start to peel that cloak off and you start to look under the dark inner recesses, then you begin to understand you're talking about a very, very different thing.
Can you give us an example of like when you sort of peeled back that layer and like you first saw that darkness?
Yeah. So what you have to begin to understand is that, and this is what I understood when I realized that I didn't understand how the world worked anymore, that everything that we do in the West can be essentially reverse engineered to promote things that we don't actually believe in. And when you start to, you know, peel back layer after layer after layer after layer of those things, then you begin to realize there's something sinister at the heart of the Communist Party. And it's, for me, it wasn't like this aha moment that I understood. It wasn't until I started peeling these layers back and understanding more fully what was going on. You know, in the beginning, it becomes, hey, this is kind of nefarious, but, you know, ultimately our society is strong enough to deal with this close connection with this very dark force. But then as you continue to pull back layers and you find that the rot just goes through and through, then you realize that it's not that we can actually heal ourselves. The close connection is causing us to change. It's almost like, you know, I don't like to use an analogy of a virus, but it really is, because it's changing the fabric of our own society in order to deal with the enormous paranoia of the Chinese Communist Party that it has with regard to the openness of the West.
Well, it's very interesting you mention that, because it's a very different idea to what U.S.-China policy was at the turn of the century, that if the U.S. and China get closer, China will change, the Communist Party will change. But from what you're saying, it seems more like the opposite is true, that relationship has started to change the U.S.
We were unable to infect China with our own freedom virus.
Well, but if you think about it, historically, it makes perfect sense. And that just shows the hubris of Americans, that we think that, and this is essentially what we thought, we'll open up to China, we'll embrace China, we'll embrace the Chinese Communist Party, and, you know, over time, they'll liberalize. And if you look at their history, China has been conquered time and time and time again. I mean, they built a giant wall, for God's sakes, to keep people out.
Because it didn't work
that well. But what ended up happening each time is that they would turn their conquerors into Chinese. And so the fact that we were going to draw China into this modern embrace of globalization and the internet, and that we were going to change them, that it's incredibly hubristic, and it doesn't recognize the fact that there is thousands of years, and I'm not, you know, imputing this thousand-year culture history to the Chinese Communist Party, but there's a lot of those things that they have used to kind of, you know, reverse engineer globalization to their own end.
So do you think that was kind of like magical thinking about how we would deal with China, or was it just that we weren't unprepared for what happened later?
No, I think if you read Kissinger's World Order, I think it's a really good way of thinking about the world. And that is, each society and culture has their own view of their own self with regard to everybody else. And for us, we believe that, you know, our culture, our beliefs are universal, and that everybody will eventually embrace them once they come to know them. And so that kind of prevents us in that hubris is a blindness to the fact that, you know, there are other cultures out there that can be just as alluring as ours, but have other values and norms wrapped up in them.
I mean, you make a good point. That's fundamental to the American experience. Anyone from anywhere in the world can come to the United States and become an American. That's really the only country that happens in. Like, there's no way any of us, except for Shelley, can go to China and become Chinese.
I am borderline at this point.
Borderline. So I have actually a great story about that. I'm sitting in Shanghai. This is 2002 or 3, and I'm having lunch with a couple professors from Tongji. And one of the guys had left kind of around Tiananmen Square time and gone to the U.S. and had kids, and they'd grown up in America, and you know, now he was back, and he said, "Wow, this place has, you know, changed." And so he's relating a story how he called his kids up back in California and said, "Hey, you know, China's back. This place is great. You guys have to move here." And they're like, "What are you talking about?" And he's like, "You're Chinese." And the kids are like, "We're Americans, and we're not coming back to China. You can stay there if you want, but you know, in that lunch, you know, he was just like shocked. Like, how can they not realize that they're actually Chinese?
Well, it's because they didn't go through enough patriotic education,
right,
in China. Yeah.
So I know you have an upcoming book. And I think it ties into a lot of what you're saying about the change in thinking about China,
right,
from China, the nation, the people, to China, the Communist Party, and how that is having a negative effect around the world. Would you like to tell us anything about that book?
I think what I – so
– remember, this is a chance for shameless self-promotion.
Yeah, right. No, I know. What I've tried to do is just relay everything I've learned in the last 6 years of studying this relationship – And lay it out in a way that is, because I have a co-writer my wife says I write like an academic. My goal is to basically write this for anybody that doesn't really understand China, so that they can understand China in the way that I see it, because of what I've been through, and hopefully in knowing that, then they'll be able to make some clear decisions on, you know, is this a good idea that, you know, essentially our entire academia, political, you know, corporate, you know, structure here in the United States thinks that, you know, having a close and personal relationship with the Chinese Communist Party is a good thing. So the idea is, you know, let the American people know what's going on, because mostly if you think about, and this is to include me, prior to ever going to China, I didn't know about China other than, you know, I thought fortune cookies came from China, right? I mean, fortune cookies were invented in San Francisco by a Japanese guy. So, I mean, we just don't know. And most American people, and this is true for highly educated people or people that have, you know, very little education, don't really understand China.
Mm-hmm. Well, so yeah, if you were talking to a millennial, what would you tell them about China? Like, how would you frame it so they understand?
I have a millennial, my son, and so we talk about, and he's learning Chinese. He really wants to go China. He lived in Shanghai. They loved it because it was such a great experience, and wants to go back. And what I try to tell him is, you know, There is this sinister underbelly that is the Chinese Communist Party that you have to be aware of. It has to be something that is always in your mind about when you go there, because as friendly and as open and as hospitable as you think the Chinese people are and China is, the Communist Party is not that. The Communist Party is something different, and you need to understand that. And I encourage him to kind of look for himself, right? Question. You know, he's much like me, which is he's not really into rules. And I try to explain that, you know, the Communist Party is into rules. and so if you want to
– That's a good summary right there.
Yeah, if you want to learn, you know, what it's like, you know, really look and pay attention and open your eyes. And quite frankly, because they're so, the Communist Party is so adept at keeping that stuff out of the limelight, that it's very hard to find those things. It's very hard to find evidence of them being oppressive in nature, but they are.
Well, so I think the American people now like have an idea like, okay, there's like concentration camps in Xinjiang.
Maybe.
Yeah, wait, no. They're boarding schools. Come on.
They're boarding vocational training schools. But so there are instances of like these extreme examples of oppression. I mean, obviously the Tiananmen Square massacre is still present in a lot of people's minds. But I think there's a sense that okay, the Communist Party might be very oppressive inside of China, but the United States itself is still somehow hermetically sealed from any of that.
Right.
From any of that. But according to you, the United States is being transformed by this authoritarian regime. How is that happening?
Well, I mean, I think one of the examples I use is the example of Roy Jones, who's a mid-level employee of Marriott Corporation who, according to him, accidentally likes a tweet about Tibet. China calls up. Marriott Corporation says, you need to do something about that. So they fire the guy. So here is an American living in Ohio working for an American corporation that, you know, according to him, actually accidentally liked the tweet. Not really. He was just interested in Tibet. Didn't know much about geopolitics or anything. That is exercising his right to free speech. That is essentially you know, suppressed because of that. And that's an example you can go out on the internet and Google. I would imagine, just based on what I've seen in terms of what gets reported, there's a lot more examples that aren't being reported. And so there's this market pull that China exerts over corporate America, and then there's this financial relationships that they use to influence how we make decisions. You know, the Wisconsin factory that Foxconn was going to put into there. When they announced that, I knew that they were never planning to actually manufacture any iPhones in Wisconsin. Mm. That was an entirely politically motivated investment. And so when they announced, well, we're not really going to do that. We're going to, you know, we're going to do engineering. We're going to hire all these engineers. And actually, we're going to hire Chinese engineers and bring them into the, you know, it wasn't surprising to me. But people in Wisconsin actually got upset. And that's why Governor Walker didn't get reelected. But if you understand the system, you would have known right off the bat, this is what's going on here. You know, so and the pattern is recreated in society after society. You know, the allure of Chinese money, the allure of the market are both used to do elite capture and create this, you know, this need to do things on behalf of your own citizenry a lot of times that, you know, so it's not like, you know, China's creating traders that, you know, are becoming, you know, aligned with the Chinese Communist Party. No, what's happening is, you know, are politicians that are looking after their own constituency. China comes in and appeals to that by creating this, you know, we're gonna have jobs for your people, and in there is a hook, and in that hook lies some kind of leverage, which allows them to use that to get the kind of behavior they want. In other words, we're going to make this big investment here. Oh, wait, you changed the policy with regard to X. Either you change that policy back to Y, or we're going to pull our investment. Of course, they may have never, you know, intended to actually invest, but it was just the announcement. This pattern is repeated over, and it's a fairly similar pattern, and it's very easy to replicate in any society.
In terms of like the pattern, let's talk about like corporations going into China. Because we were talking about this the other day, that there seems to be like in every industry, like wave after wave of like, oh, solar panel manufacturers are going into China because it's going to be a great market and they're going to manufacture, make a lot of money, and then they get screwed. Right now it's like Hollywood is going into China because there's so much money there and they're doing co-productions with Chinese production companies and it's all great. And it seems like eventually the same pattern repeats itself, but we keep doing it.
Yeah. I mean, so actually my wife and I talk about this, about the cultural DNA of Americans, and that is we have such powerful institutions in our country. In other words, the rule of law is one of them. And you have an agreement with somebody, a signed contract, the courts will enforce that contract. And so that we take over this kind of cultural baggage into our relationship with China, and we say, I've got this contract signed. All my neighbors when I lived in Shanghai were telling me horror story after horror story. This one gentleman was building a factory. It was for voltmeters. And the factory's up and running, and the Chinese come to him and say, you can no longer import those fuses that we're using for your voltmeters. You have to use Chinese fuses. And, you know, and so the company says, well, yes, if the fuse fails, then people could potentially die. So we actually won't use Chinese fuses. So he has to go to Hong Kong and have the fuses smuggled in to keep his factory running. You know, just story after story after story like this. And then you realize, and this is, you know, over 2 years, you begin to understand how you can do business in China. And that is very, very carefully. In other words, everything that you do, you have to have some leverage in the relationship in order to induce compliance with your agreement. In other words, you never pay full price up front for a service. You always leave some money back so that you – and once that service is delivered, assuming it's delivered correctly, then you pay for it. Most Chinese know this, like, you know, it comes natural. For Americans, we're just not – we're not used to that kind of relationship in terms of business, and that's because of our institutions are so strong. Number one. Number two, if you look in terms of how the Chinese Communist Party functions, as long as you're employing Chinese and you're helping grow the economy, most things are okay. The only time it becomes not okay if it creates some kind of problem that the Chinese Communist Party has to come and clean up. In other words, if you're polluting things, or if you're so abusing your employees that they're starting to revolt, then the Communist Party will step in. So it's almost like, in a lot of ways, in that sense, the Communist Party exerts power in a very libertarian sense. In other words, as much freedom up until chaos. And as soon as we see the sign of chaos, we're going to step in. Well, what happens with that and how that contrasts from the United States is that we've developed these institutions over decades that, you know, enforce environmental compliance, enforce, you know, that require that you pay your employees adequately, that you treat them with respect, and do all these things. None of those exist in China. And so, you know, when you say hermetically sealed, the ability for that to escape containment of China is very, very easy because of globalization. We're completely open to it. And so all of those things tend to spill over. And what does that look like? Well, that looks like poison dogs. That looks like, you know those scooters that explode and all these other things that, you know, we would normally protect in our own society, but then we allow to race in.
Now, I want to go back to something that you mentioned a few minutes ago, which is about elite capture. Can you talk a bit about what the Communist Party is doing in terms of elite capture, really, what that means in this country?
Yeah, what that means is they try to identify who makes the decision on whatever policy, whether it has to do with business, whether it has to do with politics, and tries to find a way to have a relationship with that person. It may be through a third party, you know, through, maybe an economic relationship or some kind of financial relationship. You know, they're not going in and paying these people off. What they're doing is trying to create a connection. And once you create a connection, then they use a lot of the general friendly nature of, you know, the way they approach this to essentially convince you that they are on your side and that they are looking for the exact same things that you are. And they can, because the Communist Party is so professional at controlling the narrative and the dialectic, that you can be absolutely 100% convinced that you've made a connection with this person. Right, and that they have your own best interests at heart, or in the case of the country, the nation's best interests at heart, when in fact they don't. And if you don't understand that, because you don't understand the difference between China, the Chinese people, and the Communist Party, then it's very easy for you to be sucked in. As I was telling Chris earlier, you know, I struggle myself in dealing with friends in China, because especially if they're in the People's Liberation Army or members of the Communist Party, because on the one aspect, I recognize that they're people and they have, you know, all the same, you know, kind of, you know, human characteristics that I have. But at the same time, I also have to understand that they are part of an organization that tests their loyalty at every second, at every day. And through that loyalty, they demonstrate their ability to move up the ranks. So the more senior the Communist Party official, the more loyal they have demonstrated that they are. And so if you don't separate the two, right, we can have a friendly conversation, but at the same time, I know every single time you engage me, there is a purpose to that engagement. It is not specifically in the higher ranks of the Communist Party. They have a purpose to the engagement. It's not merely because, you know, you're a nice guy and you speak good Chinese and, you know, I'm genuinely interested in you as a person. I have a goal, and you may not know what that goal is, and you probably will never find out what the goal is, but there is a goal behind that.
Can you think of an example of a specific person, without obviously slandering them, that has been elite captured, so it's a little bit clearer?
Well, I mean, I was elite captured, you know, before I began to understand. I think there's a lot of people in government, and I would prefer not to call people out because when you start to really dig into this, and it becomes very, very personal very, very quickly. And I remember vividly when we were having the first kind of – I had this series of kind of informal discussions we called Winning Without War. And in the first discussion, we had a discussion going on about, you know, what – I think at the time it was about intellectual property theft or something. And, you know, somebody made the comment about somebody else that, oh, you're a panda hugger. And then the whole room erupted. And, you know, it became this, you know, personal accusation back and forth. And, you know, at the end of the meeting, I stood up and I said, look, you know, what we have to realize is that the competitor is, you know, 6,000 miles away. It's not in this room. You know, as Americans, we're all alcoholics. In other words, we've all been kind of lured into this, and there's not one that's less culpable than any other, or more culpable than any other, because, you know, for the most part, we've been drunk on the allure of China. But I can tell you that at the highest levels of our government, at the highest levels of academia, at the highest levels of our corporate elites, that there are relationships that cause people to do things that are inimical to U.S. national interests, not because they're bad people, not because they do it deliberately to undermine the U.S. Constitution, but because they have been convinced that this relationship is so important to the future of the United States that it's okay that we kind of look away when the Chinese Communist Party does X.
I think that really is key to understanding the situation, that most Americans don't understand that the Chinese Communist Party is a hostile foreign government that has openly stated its intent to supplant the United States, to wage a campaign of unrestricted warfare. So, like, nobody – it's not as simple as, like, oh, we're going to get paid by the Chinese Communist Party and we're going to sell state secrets because we want to undermine the United States. It's much more subtle than that. It's done through this sort of veneer of friendship. And the fact that people don't understand the essential nature that this is war by other means.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I try not to use the word war because people get confused and they associate that term with armed conflict, and that's why I use competition. I think it's a different way. Certainly, if you go back to kind of the definition of war from Clausewitz, that war is politics by other means. Then you can say, in essence, your assertion is correct, and that is they are doing politics by other means, and what that looks like,
they're at politics with us.
They're politics, right? And there's politics with multilateral institutions. So one of the interesting things that comes out of the Trump administration is the idea that the Trump administration is isolationist, right? And because it doesn't really like multilateral institutions, because it likes bilateral relationships, and I remember vividly people constantly coming into my office and saying we're destroying, you know, you guys are destroying the liberal democratic order, and I would say, the liberal democratic order, can you explain to me where that exists? And the example I would use is, okay, in the fall of 2016, there's a vote on human rights at the UN with regard to China, and the EU votes with the Chinese, right? And so here's a democratic multilateral institution with a lot of NATO allies in it that votes with a totalitarian regime. Okay, why is that? Well, because of Greece and Hungary. They basically were, as countries, elite captured by the Chinese. And so now the EU is voting with a totalitarian regime. So, you know, in essence, what the national security strategy tried to do is figure out a way to change things back in kind of that would, in a way that would promote democratic institutions. We had to realize that just opening markets was not sufficient to promoting democratic principles. We actually had to talk about them. We actually had to demonstrate adherence to human rights and democratic principles. And I think what you're seeing now is Secretary Pompeo go around and start talking about Xinjiang and talking about Venezuela and talking about oppression abroad and human rights. That's important. That's who we are as a people. But that had to go along with free markets. And so as we were going around talking to other democracies, we're saying the same things. And this is what's going on behind the scenes now. The administration is talking bilaterally to our democratic partners and allies saying, hey, this is what's going on. We're essentially having a transplant of illiberal norms through this openness, and we need to band together as democracies and begin to staunch that that flow. And I think they're having overall pretty good reception to that, but it takes time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know organizations like Freedom House have said there's been a backslide in democracy and democratic values.
Right.
China is a big part of that.
Right, absolutely. It's not accidentally. You know, there are deliberate attempts by them to suppress the things that they find that could be potentially damaging to their continued control over the society.
One thing I definitely want to get into with you in just a moment is about 5G, because I know that's an area of expertise for you. One thing that I think just needs to be brought up first is, you know, we've talked about elite capture, but that is still just a narrow scope of what the Chinese Communist Party is doing. So Shelley had mentioned earlier about Hollywood, and you see China's efforts to control Hollywood and co-produce as a way of not just going after specific elites, but also changing the American public as a whole, their view of China.
Well, I think, first of all, that think about, you know, what's always been the prevailing view is that Hollywood and Coca-Cola, we're going to transform the world with that, right? And so what has China done? They've basically taken a hold of that model and tried, you know, it's been clumsy. And if you read Sharp Power, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy's report on influence, and then I think the Hoover Institute just did one on influence. If you look at those reports and you find that, you know, yes, you know, overall China's effort at propagandizing the world has been quite clumsy and not really well received, but that's not really what they do. They do obfuscation. They hide what they're doing. And so when they do elite capture, they don't actually that doesn't get reported. If there's a contract for a port, that's always done in secret. If there's any money changing hands, there's never any that's never out in the open. And so all this obfuscation is hidden in what is becoming a very, very interesting, from a technology perspective, influence capability by not just, you know, nation states, but also organizations like ISIS. In other words, the convergence of social media, of mobile computing, of big data analysis and artificial intelligence, the ability to target individuals and their networks for influence in ways that, you know, heretofore was really impossible unless you actually control the government. And so what this looks like is from a network perspective, you have an audience, right? You have a network that listens to you. And say that audience has a set of beliefs, and that audience, that network, if you will, is very close in some respects to another network, but there's certain things in that other network that they don't believe in. What is possible now with technology and artificial intelligence and big data analysis and social media is the ability to use automation in some respects, sometimes really live people, to get into your network and begin to move them in ways that align them with another network's beliefs in ways that would be absolutely contrary to what you believe. Now, we saw this in 2016 in a big way with the Russians. They are getting better at it. The Chinese are learning from that capability. And, you know, so that ability to use technology to influence people because of our own openness is just – it's going to increase. And with the evolution of 5G, the ability to have much more clear knowledge about who people are and what they do, their patterns of behavior, that's just going to increase. The ability to use machine learning, artificial intelligence, the accumulation of data – really, the information domain becomes the most important domain in terms of how do you influence a society or a network or a people. It becomes even more important as time goes forward and as this technology begins to evolve. Specifically with regard to 5G, you're moving from a world where you've got 10,000 connected devices per square mile to 3 million devices per square mile. That means you have the ability to have much more finite detailed knowledge about the people that are in that square mile and what they do. And then because the CPU-based environment is completely corrupt and really can't be protected, we clearly see that. There's no government or computer that's attached to the internet that hasn't been hacked. Once you have the ability to get that data, then the ability to use big data analysis and machine learning, artificial intelligence to use that for things that are beyond what the people of that society intend is incredibly powerful. Now, that's not just for totalitarian regimes like the Chinese Communist Party. It's also for companies like Facebook and Amazon and Google. And if you think about, how do you tie together in a digital space the values that make us a democracy, along with the ability to enforce those values in that space, that is a piece where that essentially technology has gone beyond the ability of our Constitution, for example, to actually create the kind of world in a digital sense that we enjoy every single day. In other words, rule of law, individual liberty, sovereignty, private property, all of those things exist. In the physical world, they don't exist in the digital world. And there's no borders in the digital world. So what tends to happen then is whoever collects the most data has the most power in that world. And so if you take the control of the data along with a set of principles, which is, we'll deliver economic growth on a continuous basis to the Chinese people, but you suppress your speech, your religion, and you give us the free ability to oppress. And by the way, I extend that model out because I'm building everybody else's network. Then it becomes an incredibly powerful tool for expanding the power of the Chinese Communist Party just through openness.
I think that's probably one of the clearest explanations of this that I've seen. Because, already we've seen the effect of advertisers, how they can influence us with just with the current amount of data we're producing. But with 5G, we're all going to be producing just unheard of levels of data that can be collected and then used to manipulate us. So it makes sense that you have like Chinese telecom company Huawei, which has some, shall we say...
Oh, it's totally a private company.
It's totally a private company. Right. No back doors. But you can see why the Chinese Communist Party is actively pushing Huawei on the 5G market.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look today, so what do we do online? We bank, we shop, we fall in love. I mean, we literally do everything online.
Let's not talk about everything we do online.
Well, yeah. So anyway, most of those companies now are becoming Chinese companies, right? And so now, if you're doing your shopping online in the company you're doing that shopping from is a Chinese company, and you're doing your social media online and that's a Chinese company, and you're doing your banking online and that's a Chinese company. Well, so how are they able to begin to automate control of the society in China? It's a social media or social credit score, right? So How does that work? You know, do Chinese people feel like they're oppressed? No, they are actually happy. Why? Because if you follow the rules, you get cheaper prices. You get preferential treatment, and if you can extend that beyond your borders, right? Because you're creating these global champions, then you can extend that ability to have that kind of influence on large populations. It's not hard. Amazon already does it, right? With Amazon Prime.
It's so convenient.
It is convenient.
So you're saying all we have to do is give the Communist Party control and we'll get low prices?
Get low prices. That's it.
I mean, really, that's all I ever wanted.
That's right. Just as long as you don't say anything against the Communist Party, which then you'll get high prices. And you'll get, you know,
We don't say anything negative. We don't say anything negative about the Communist Party.
Can I change stances now? is that still on the table?
Well, I think, you know, it's probably in your own best interest that you hedge a little bit. So
okay.
Maybe create another online persona that you can basically cancel this one and then go to.
Chris, how about you
always say good things? I mean, that's have two personas. How about that?
I've got a channel where – it's just you visiting different zoos around the world and hugging the pandas.
That would be great.
Yeah. Well, I made a premature decision growing a beard. I grew a beard recently. I should have waited and then had the beard persona be the pro-China one and say the unbearded one was the evil
twin.
That's
brilliant.
Yeah.
Or you can always use glasses or, you know, just something, you know. But of course, now you've got these things where you check your DNA to see, you know, what, you know, where you come from, and that gets put in the database.
Oh my gosh!
And now you can't get away from it.
It's even that level. Well, I'm depressed.
Can we go back and talk about the economic side of things a little bit? What do you think about the trade negotiations?
Well, I mean, so anybody that's ever negotiated in China knows that negotiations don't end with a deal. It's just the beginning. Structurally, the Chinese economy works the way it does for the Communist Party because of the way it's structured. In other words, they have the levers of incentives both for their own companies and for other companies operating from abroad. And if they were to change those levers in any material way that prevents them from having that kind of incentive system around it, then you begin to actually impact the Chinese Communist Party. So what that means is they actually can't have a deal that structurally looks like a deal that would be fair and reciprocal from the United States standpoint. So, the narrative about this is all over the place. There's going to be a big deal. There's going to be no deal. I think there's going to be a deal. I think it's going to be an imperfect deal. And I think because it's an imperfect deal, it's going to continue to have the same kind of problems, which is essentially that our two economies are lashed up in such a way that our own corporate enterprise are doing things that are not in Americans' best interest. And so over time, that's just going to fall apart too. And so there'll be a deal. It'll be an imperfect deal, but it won't be a lasting deal. I think, as I said before, we're on a trajectory to either decouple or, you know, as I say to the Chinese Communist Party, you know, you can't have a fulsome, you know, strong relationship with the American people who believe in these four freedoms equally, not one over the other, and have, you know, your need to suppress three of them. Right,
what were those four freedoms? I think you mentioned that on the video.
Yeah, so it's freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, and freedom from want. It was actually immortalized in a series of Norman Rockwell paintings that were essentially paraded around the United States, in the early 40s for a year by the Saturday Evening Post. In fact, when God bless her, my wife, when we got to Beijing to be the defense attaché, the next day I had to leave to go to the Pacific Command, and she was had to set up our apartment so that we could have a dinner party as soon as I got back. So I got back, and she had all these Norman Rockwell paintings hung in the house, and she had the Four Freedom paintings hung above our dinner table. So every time I had people over, I would talk them through the four freedoms, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, freedom from want, what those mean to the American people. Now, the first two, freedom of speech and freedom of religion, obviously we know from our Bill of Rights. The next two are really what President Roosevelt in his 1941 State of the Union address kind of put forth as the structure under which we would build a new world order that was not about war, armed conflict, but more about friendly nations working together to promote universal principles. This is the thing that, you know, if you ask what was most damaging to the United States, if you say what's most damaging to the Chinese Communist Party, it's those four freedoms. It is those freedoms that they fear the most, not aircraft carriers, not fighter jets, not nuclear weapons. It is the idea that the Chinese people would realize that, hey, we deserve those, right? The idea that and this is what I heard when I first got to China, and of course I took it hook, line, and sinker. The Chinese people aren't ready for democracy, right? It's something so foreign to them that they could never accept that.
Ignore Taiwan,
and of course I bought it, and most people do buy it. They're speaking, about their own country, and we're there as visitors. I'm sure that they would, but I mean, it's part of this narrative. And the Chinese people, because since the end of June 4th, there's been this compulsory education, and they buy into it hook, line, and sinker. Yeah, we're not ready for democracy. We couldn't handle that. We Luan Chi Bazao. We're gonna just, it'll be crazy if we have that. So anyway,
yeah, it's crazy, and also our system is superior.
Right, of course, because it's been around for 5,000. That's the other thing. The Chinese government, the communist government, has been in existence since 1949. But then they assume this cloak of 5,000 years of cultural history and say we've been around for 5,000 years. Well, actually, you've been a government for less time than the United States. You're actually quite young as a government compared to the United States.
Their idea from some European guy, right? Karl Marx.
No, right. That's Chinese characteristics.
Right. Yes, now. Chinese characteristics. Yes, right. Correct.
But it's very interesting you say this because, you're not talking about what makes the United States strong is not necessarily the physical things like the money or its battleships, but it's the sort of the morals, the spirit of the United States that is what makes it so powerful.
The ability to be self-correcting, to actually do serious introspection and say we're not doing things correctly, and so there's a lot of people in the United States that essentially criticize the country for all the past sins that it's had, but at the same time we have this enormous capacity to constantly reinvent ourselves, to constantly improve, and I think that's what so appealing to me about the country is this ability to just constantly become, a more perfect union.
I have a story about this, which is my sister and I were taking a road trip down to Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. Philly, we stopped to see the Liberty Bell. They have a movie that they play about the history of the Liberty Bell and whatever. And there was a group of Chinese tourists there. And part of it, they had it playing in Chinese. And part of it, at the end of the movie, it talks about how the Liberty Bell is like this symbol to Americans of all the people around the world who still do not have their freedom yet. And then one of the shots they showed was Tiananmen Square.
Oh, wow.
And then beside me, one of the girls in this Chinese tour group like leaned over and whispered to her friend, "Is that China?" Like, just what? Like, probably had never seen that before.
Oh, wow.
In her 20s. And then later on that same trip, my sister and I are in, oh my gosh, why did I just suddenly blank? The place where the Declaration of Independence is. Help me out. National Archives.
Oh, the Rotunda.
Yeah, so we're in the National Archives and there's a museum, and they had a museum exhibit that was basically about a lot of the terrible things that America's done in the past. Like, it talked about the Chinese Exclusion Act. It talked about the Civil Rights Movement. It talked about, the women's, suffrage issues and things like that. And, just the fact that the American government has this museum where they are showing people publicly all of the not great things we did in our history versus those Chinese tour group who had never seen an image of the Tiananmen Square demonstrations. It was just mind-blowing for me, and I like stood and cried in the National Archives.
Yeah, so for me, going to the National Archives for the first time, seeing the Bill of Rights, seeing the Constitution, seeing the Declaration, it was a religious, you know, moment for me. You know, I teared up as well because, you know, it really you when you look at those documents and you think about the thought, the forethought that went into them, to realize that the natural order of humanity is for man to oppress man. That is just where if things are left to their own devices, whoever's in charge will seek to impose their way of thinking on everybody else. And that happens time and time again in history. And so here's some folks that come together and say, okay, we want something different, right? We don't want anybody to be able to impose, you know, today we have Democrats and Republicans. Back then you had Tories and Whigs. We don't want anybody to come in and impose their own view of the world on us. We want to be able to have our own views. And maybe we can live together, but we can disagree about how the world works or how we think the world should work. But I'm not going to be able to make you do what I want you to do, and you're not going to make me do what you want me to do. And I think that's incredibly powerful. I mean, at the end of the day, the thing that we have that is the most powerful thing right now in the entire world is the idea of our Constitution and what it, you know, really aspires to be, and that is this document of ideas, this country of ideas that actually allows for us to live together, have disagreements, but still be able to, you know, deal with one another. And ultimately, you know, whoever's idea wins, it is really an idea meritocracy. It is not like, you know, your idea gets to hold sway because, you know, you come from a certain background, you have a certain, monetary, status. It is really about what is the character of your ideas. And I think that is the thing that frightens the Chinese Communist Party more than anything else. The problem is, and that's the problem of our society today with globalization and the internet, our ability to basically maintain that sense of ourself is under attack every single day through the internet, through our financial transactions, through our trade transactions, through our immigration policy, through our investment, you know, foreign investment policy, through media. You know, if you go along each one of these avenues, for instance, media, who controls the narrative about who China is or what China is? The Chinese Communist Party, particularly to the diaspora. They completely control all Chinese language media throughout the globe. And so, you know, the idea that you get of China comes from the Chinese Communist Party. And so this is incredible. Globalization and the internet is incredible. We thought was this incredible force for openness. Remember, President Clinton talking about, you know, there's no way that China can, you know, fight the internet. It is this ultimate democratizing,
no,
you know, phenomenon.
He was wrong about
everything. It was designed on essentially a foundation of quicksand. The CPU as kind of the way it was, the technology that it was designed around was about speed and connectivity, you know, particularly in the internet. And we tried to add on security after we found out that, hey, this is an avenue for, you know, other things to happen. And we found out, well, we can't actually secure it. And that's really where, you know, we were going with the whole secure 5G. If you're going to have 5G, then for God's sakes, let's build it secure so that you own your data and I own my data and I can't take your data and you can't take my data and I can't manipulate your intentions without you knowing it, and you can't do it to mine. That's a really democratizing idea, right? Creating those same types of principles that we have in our own Constitution, but you have to build that into the technology. It has to be designed in. CPUs aren't gonna save us from China because it was never designed to be a democratizing technology.
So you're saying Huawei wouldn't build their 5G network with respecting individual freedom?
They can't, because if you think about it, the Chinese Communist Party needs access to that data so they can monitor their population and ensure that they don't have wrong thoughts. You know, when you're talking about the Liberty Bell thing, I was thinking about there was an article recently talking about the censors in Facebook, right? Also, there's an article talking about the censors in China. What were they both talking about? They were talking about how they trained those censors, and particularly the ones in China. And this is you're gonna understand what I'm saying when you brought up the Tiananmen Square thing. This is the first time the people in China, you know, the ones that are working in centers, actually get to learn about their own history, because they have to teach them about their history so that they know what they're supposed to censor. And so this is the first time they realize that, oh my God, Tiananmen Square happened? Right? They're teaching the censors. And there was an epiphany I had, you know, if we kept going in the same vein that we are, and that is the only people that would know history would be the censors, because they would be the ones that have to be taught about what things need to be suppressed so that people don't get the wrong idea. And it was funny because in the article, when they interviewed the Chinese, they said, now, do you go home and tell your family about this? Oh, no, because that could start rumors. You know, this is
not something for people to know.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not, they shouldn't know this. But, I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, fortunately, someday they can replace those sensors with AI algorithms, and then no one will need to know.
Oh, my God. I remember that article and, like, how, like, mind-blowing that sentence was, where the guy was just like, no, I don't tell anybody about this. People don't need to know this. Yeah.
and I think that really is the key to understanding things. Like, what do you want as the next global superpower? A country that can, you know, have a museum dedicated to the failings, that tries to learn something better from that, or a country that suppresses all information about anything bad?
And I think that's a good point. And what I saw over the last 6 years is we essentially have a clash of two world orders. The first one is what we would call liberal democratic order, and that's where the United States is the most powerful. It has a series of internationally mediated rules and norms and institutions like UN, WTO, Bretton Woods, what have you. And then there's a security or a set of security alliances, military alliances, that underpin that system, system one. System two is led by China. It's primarily governed by Chinese domestic law. In other words, if you look at all national security law, cybersecurity law, the maritime security law, none of those laws have any geography built into where China claims sovereignty. In other words, wherever China has an interest, China's law trumps international law. And finally, it's underpinned, as opposed to system one, by a series of economic and financial relationships. And so I was trying to figure out, why is the United States not able to get to promote democratic principles in the international political space? Why is the world working in favor of totalitarian regimes? And I just realized that just like the Communist Party has kind of slid over the top and acted as sovereign over China. In other words, you have the Chinese people, Chinese government, Chinese Communist Party operates at the top, controls the levers of everything. It was doing the same thing in the geopolitical space. In other words, the UN now is working not to promote democratic principles, as is outlined in its founding documents, but actually acting to promote illiberal norms, because system one no longer has control of the what's going on. And the best example of that I go back to is the EU voting with China, against sanctioning them for human rights violations. You know, so clearly, you know, democratic principles is no longer, even for democratic multilateral institutions, is no longer holding sway. It is being overridden by this need, this terrible need everywhere for economic growth, and there's a reason for that, and that is because these economic and financial connections have allowed China. So you have to question, how can a country grow at 6.5 to 12% per year for almost 40 years? How does that happen? Well, that's because there's this uneven nature of these relationships, and their uneven nature exists everywhere. In other words, if you look at all of America's allies and partners, and you just looked at trade is just one of the issues. If you just looked at trade, we are upside down with every single one of those allies and partners. In other words, before WTO, the U.S. would have been the number one trading partner with those countries. Now China is, in every instance, the number one trading partner. What that means is, rather than democratic principles and free market principles coexisting to strengthen universal norms around the world, you have totalitarian principles with free market principles actually pushing totalitarianism everywhere.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing all of this. Obviously, there is a lot more to learn. If somebody listening wanted to learn more about these topics or about you, where should they go? What should they do? Because I know you have a book coming out soon.
Yeah, you know, I try to, you know, my one indulgence after I left the military was to start tweeting. Like, that was the first thing that I did. You know, I didn't, you know, take a drink of alcohol or, you know, you go party. I went and sent my first tweet. So I try to take, you know, I like the format where I can take a few characters and just explain an article or something in just a little bit different way. That's primarily the way I'm doing it right now.
What's your Twitter handle?
It's Robert_Spalding. No you in Spalding. Like you said, a book is forthcoming. I think when that book comes out, I'm going to try to be far more open in terms of engaging with the public.
Well, when that book comes out, we'd love to have you back on and talk some more about that.
Great. I'd love it.
Well, thank you again, General. This was fantastic to listen to.
It was a joy, and I feel like there's so much more that we can talk about that to get down in the specifics. But
well, until next time,
the next podcast will be 10 hours.
Yeah.
All right, and thank you for everyone listening today. We'll provide some of those links that we can. Well, it's the hashtag @Robert_Spalding. No you.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to this episode of China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
And don't forget to leave us a good review on iTunes and subscribe to us on whatever platform you use. Thank you.